Welcome to The Month End, a CPG community chat. The Month End will provide emerging CPG brands real-life knowledge into the accounting, finance, and operational world. Our guests will be key stakeholders from those same brands, as well as other key contributors to the industry, which all have vast experiences and insights that will be shared with the audience. I'm very excited about the first ever episode of The Month End with Jason Burke, the Chief Hunter-Gatherer at The New Primal. How are you doing today, Jason?
I'm doing well, Brad. How are you?
Doing great. This is actually a very interesting kind of kickoff to this form of video interview that we're going to be doing here at The Month End, you know, sponsored by Accountfully. When my wife and I launched Accountfully 8-9 years ago, we promised ourselves we're not going to get into the have clients in the inventory space. Well, we ended up meeting Jason and Melissa at The New Primal back in 2014. I was looking at my notes. We took them on as a client. So we were growing a business. They needed accounting and bookkeeping support. We added value to them, and they went ahead and told all their friends about us at the Expo East, Expo West trade shows across the nation. And now, as we look at it back 5 years, 6 years ago, now the majority of our clients are inventory-based clients, and the majority of those inventory-based clients are within the kind of the CPG natural food and drink space. So it's a very interesting kind of kickoff to this interview, and I'm really excited this conversation with Jason. So, Jason, everything going well over at The New Primal?
Yeah, man, I have no complaints, and I appreciate you having me on and being a part of the inaugural episode here. It is interesting how things come full circle, and yeah, man, we have no complaints right now. We've been really fortunate through some times where I know a lot of people have had tough times, and I'm empathetic towards that, but you know, fortunately for us, and I'll, you know, keep banging on this desk, we've been able to weather the storm.
Awesome. Yeah. Very glad to hear with all the COVID situations going on here. So while we get started here, let's get a little background on what's going on at The New Primal. So first off, you're the chief hunter-gatherer of The New Primal. Have you ever really defined what that means from a title perspective?
Not really. It just means that I sign anything that creates liability for the company. Yeah, so it just really means that. Or if there's ever a really big decision and no one wants the repercussions to fall on them, it falls on me. I call myself a founder a lot more than, you know, a CEO per se. I don't have CEO experience other than what I've done here at The New Primal. And so, founder or chief hunter gatherer, again, it just means that I sign really important documents and usually, tie up my entire family's financial future in those documents. That's usually what that means.
I hear you on that as a fellow business owner. So clearly, when we started our relationship from a business perspective back in May of 2014, your business at that point was very different than it is now. And so as we move forward with this kind of interview and the content, the questions we're going to ask, really the target market for the listening in are those emerging brands in the $0 to $2 million annual revenue space of trying to get some understanding around the accounting, finance, operational infrastructure of their business and how they can leverage past experiences from people like yourself to make better decisions or to make better contacts or move forward in a different manner within their business. So while we get started, kind of tell us kind of about The New Primal, where were you 5 years ago and kind of where you're at today. And all that stuff, and then we'll get into some specifics around sales channels, inventory management, things like that along the way. So just give us a little background of The Primal.
Sure. Yeah, look, and like most people that would be listening to this are early stage entrepreneurs who are growing, you know, consumer brands. This business was started out of passion, really not a lot of experience, but a lot of passion. We found that, you know, for me, it really just began with, you know, we started making beef jerky. And it was by accident. And it was really because I went paleo out of, you know, two of my parents were diagnosed with chronic illnesses. I got really, really interested in diet and nutrition. I went paleo back in 2009 before anybody was talking about that. And one of my homemade sort of snacks that I would take to work all the time was beef jerky. And people would take it off my desk all the time. And then I finally made people start paying me to make them beef jerky. It was one dehydrator to the next, and I had six of them going in my house, and my wife finally said, listen, you got to get this stuff out of our house. And that was sort of the aha moment, maybe we're onto something. And so again, without background in CPG or without really knowing what I was doing and a lot of blind enthusiasm, I rented a catering space and started making beef jerky and set up a website. And then, you know, had some sort of success in spite of ourselves. And then meet you in 2014, and we have some sales going on. And in 2014, we probably did, under $1 million in sales, maybe $700,000 in sales that year. And I would say, you know, a lot of hard work, and a lot of just sort of selling to anybody and everybody that we could. But still not really knowing what we were doing, and, you know, books were a mess and we needed lots of help. And so that's how we met you guys. But essentially, you know, the brand has evolved extensively since then. We, we started out trying to take the gas station out of beef jerky, and we're the first company to launch a grass-fed beef jerky into retail. And then, today, if I fast forward to today, it's evolved significantly. And we just moved into a new 5,000 square foot office here. As the team is growing, and we need to continue to make space for that. And we have 33 products on the national planogram at Whole Foods, 22 of those being in, or 24 of those being in condiments. And so the brand extended into condiments also by accident back in 2017, where we were trying to scale up beef jerky operations. And one of the ways we were trying to scale that was to make the marinade or the recipe for the beef jerky in advance and ship it into a manufacturing partner. And it just so happens that that product turned out to be a good all-purpose cooking sauce and at-home marinade. And it got the attention of one of our friends at Whole Foods. And so the company that started as a grass-fed beef jerky company all of a sudden has its first national product with Whole Foods being a marinade. We didn't intend to be a lifestyle brand or a platform brand out of the gate. We were just passionate about this thing called paleo. And we were making something that I knew how to make. And so just sort of very organically and sometimes by accident, sort of unfolded into this kind of multi-category brand. And then we just began looking for gaps that we could fill in the marketplace where we could make a better for you option. And so really the brand has expanded from, you know, at home making beef jerky on my kitchen counter to today, probably 50,000 points of distribution. The number one selling barbecue sauce at Whole Foods nationally, the number one selling wing sauce, the number one selling marinade, the number two meat snack. It's been a pretty awesome evolution. I wish I could say it was all by design, but it's not. I'm not that smart, I'm not that good, but I was certainly stubborn enough to stick around and not give up.
Well, congratulations on all that growth and where you're at today. It is kind of crazy how you, from my experience as a business owner, you move forward, you make decisions, things change, you have to make different decisions, pivot, and it sounds like you've done that as you guys have grown your business, enhanced it of, oh, maybe this will work better, and maybe that'll work better, and somehow as your core focus is this, now it turns into a completely different thing or a complement of it. So awesome work on all that stuff, and that's some really great background. So kind of clearly where you're at now as a business, if we kind of, you know, move forward of where you're selling your, you know, what are your sales channels, where you're selling now and maybe where you were selling kind of 5 years ago. Can you kind of identify those for us, please?
Sure. Yeah. And I'll tell you early on, and it's a trap, by the way. And so if there's anybody listening that will listen to this, the trap is to sell, you know, go as wide as you can on a channel basis or, you know, sell to as many people as you can, or just keep making calls until someone starts buying, and it's a trap early on. Early on, we tried to sell everything. You know, it was online, it was in natural grocery, it was in conventional grocery, it was in convenience stores, it was in outdoor and recreational stores, it was in coffee shops. And so, you know, we didn't have a strategy because one, we didn't know. And two, I would sell to anybody that would pick up the phone or anybody that would consider it. And early on, what happens is all your friends are telling you, you know where you should sell this product, right? And everybody's giving you that kind of advice. And you go chase those rabbit holes.
Yeah.
So, you know, one good piece of advice I would give is like pick a channel or two and really like commit to it before you try to go too wide. And so back in 2017, when we sort of accidentally found ourselves selling condiments as well, we had to stop and ask ourselves, you know, who's our core consumer and who are we selling to and how do we want to serve them first and how can we grow the business sustainably? And so in 2017, I said, stop everything. And we said, we're going to commit to the natural retail channel only. We know how to build relationships. We have good relationships with a handful of key accounts. Whole Foods had become a new sort of, you know, really great partnership for us. And I said, we're gonna focus on natural grocery first. That's where our core consumer shops. That's where they discover new products. That's your consumer that's gonna adopt you the easiest early on. And we're gonna focus there. We're gonna get good there. We're gonna understand that channel there. And then the things that work well and the things that we think will then also serve the conventional grocery channel, then we'll take items from the natural channel and take it into conventional grocery. And then from there, once we, you know, again, we dig deep, we understand it, we feel like we've gotten the products out far enough, then we'll look at what the next channel is, whether that's convenience or whether that's, you know, big box or whether that's drug, you know, whatever the next channel might be. And so we worked with what we knew after the first couple of years of fumbling around and you know, trying to be all things to all people. We found that, okay, well, we're good at building relationships and our core consumer finds products at natural grocery stores. Focus there first. And I think it's a trap to go too wide, too far. It's a trap to then also, like, we're based in the Southeast and, you know, we had accounts in Northern California, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, if you don't have any accounts in the Southeast and all your accounts are in Northern California, you know, there are things that you miss and you can't, you don't learn how to service those accounts. And so I would take it a step further. And if you can not only be channel specific, but you can also then be region specific. And until you sort of, you know, fully saturate a certain region in that channel, I would be very cautious about going too far outside of your region early on.
Yeah, that's interesting. Many of our clients are, you know, omni-channel. They sell on direct consumer, mostly via Shopify, Amazon, through distribution, the big guys, the Unify, the KEs, direct wholesale, some food service, you know, across the entity. As you guys kind of grew your business and were in different sales channels and kind of segmented your sales channels kind of along the way, did you kind of have specific reporting within the sales channel to understand, you know, what is your gross revenue needs, your gross profit margin, your contribution margin, your operating profit after you're, you know, advertising within that specific, you know, channel and all the trade spend, everything that goes to distribution. Did you guys break it out in a way that you can make good decisions, or was that not something you did right away?
Not right away. I mean, right away, we had no idea. We had no idea if, like, natural grocery had higher margins than conventional grocery or if our online presence was doing better. Not right away. I would say it's a gap and something we probably could have done earlier. You know, I think that, you know, we just had such a grow as fast as you can mindset. There's a lot of stuff that we just kind of, you know, let sit for too long. That's a good way to burn cash, by the way. So if you can burn cash and you can raise money fast, that might be a strategy that works for you. I don't encourage it, having been through that. So, you know, today, for example, we do split trade spend into two big buckets. We have a performance-based trade spend and a non-performance-based trade spend, which is one key thing that we do track. You know, performance-based would be your all your marketing that you do within those channels. So it's your advertising, your, you know, your scans and your discounts at the grocery shelf. It's, you know, all the stuff you do in store to drive trial and awareness. Non-performance trade spend is going to be your slotting fees, the cost of an ad, not the scans, but the cost of an ad, like the things that don't move the needle, but just the cost of doing business. I want to track that because, you know, non-performance trade spend can also be an indicator of how fast we're growing, you know, how many new doors we're adding at a time. And then, you know, we can drill into those categories then to see, okay, in non-performance trade spend, it's all conventional grocery, or in non-performance trade spend, it's just all slotting fees for, you know, the next key retailer in the natural channel or whatever it might be. But then performance trade spend, I can tie directly to new sales, and then determine, okay, you know, is this driving new sales, or is this just kind of supplementing? And so, you know, we can now drill down quite a bit. But I would say the two big buckets to get right early would be, you know, performance and non-performance. And that's a, you know, again, because non-performance or both have a huge impact on cash, huge impact on gross margin. Yeah. And those are, you know, cash is king in this space, right? And you know, if I could do it over again, I would grow slower at first, right? I would be very channel disciplined. I'd be okay with growing slower and having a healthier cash position. Because that, it just gives you so much more leverage to do everything. And so early on, we didn't have that leverage, and you know, we certainly knows how to we know how to raise equity with a gun to our head, and I you know, I don't suggest that either. But you know, again, two big buckets early on, you know, performance based and non performance based trade spend would be really critical, I think, to monitor in that process.
Yeah, that's great insight. I mean, you know what, understanding, I think within, you know, the distribution space and those specific trade spend buckets are really helpful in getting that in place. I think in summary for anybody that's listening to this is, no matter which sales channel you're in, ensure that you have proper reporting on what really you're spending your money on, what is the ROI that you're spending your money on, what is the margins within that, and that allows you to make better decisions of, do I want to stay in the sales channel or do I not want to stay in the sales channel? Do I want to put more money in promotions and ads within the sales channel because I see a huge opportunity for growth? And when you have it segmented at that level, then you're able to just make better decisions moving forward.
100%. Yeah. And look, even if it's online, right, and it's like an Amazon strategy, and you know, there are lots of fees and things baked into that, right, from a fulfillment and operational standpoint, and you have to determine, is that profitable? And maybe it's not, and maybe your goal is, you're okay with it not being profitable, and it's a marketing play.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can't, without that information, you can't make that decision. You know, you see sales growing, but your cash continues to get depleted, and you don't know why, then you can't fix it.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. You just see deposits in your account and the deposits keep, you know, increasing. You're like, wow, my bank balance is growing. It's like, whoa, we have to understand what is really the accrual-based impact here. What is gross? What is gross profit margin? What is contribution margin? What is it after advertising? And some people are like, oh my God, I'm losing a ton of money. Well, if you're losing money and you have a lot of cash, if you're saying it's more of an advertising or promotion and brand equity play, maybe it's okay, right? Or maybe you're just in a position to make those things. So that's all great information to have, I think, in summary there. Just ensuring that you're segmenting your kind of financials and reporting in some sort of manner that can add value to, you know, to make better decisions for your business. From an inventory kind of supply chain standpoint, right? Like understanding margins, understanding inventory, understanding when to buy product, et cetera. Can you kind of give us a little bit of your supply chain and procurement process and complexity, maybe even through from 5 years ago to where you are now, whether you were you know, turnkey co-packer, in-house manufacturing, a mix of it all, kind of give us an idea of where that's going on or where it's at or where it has been as well.
Yeah, and we've done all of it. So, you know, we had our own manufacturing for a while. We did all of our own procurement early on. That's a really tough way to go. I think in the consumer space, it's really hard to make a product and also sell it and do both of those things really well. And it doesn't mean you can't do it, but I just think that's very difficult. We did that. We realized early on that we're better sellers and marketers and storytellers and those kinds of things than we are manufacturers. So we outsourced manufacturing early on, fully outsourced, but we still controlled the supply chain, meaning, and we still bought all of our raw materials and controlled sort of all of those things. I think that might be necessary early on in some cases, but as soon as we could, or as soon as we had a little bit of scale and we could negotiate with the right co-manufacturer, we looked for a turnkey opportunity as fast as we could, primarily because in the early days, and again, we grew fast, and I don't necessarily advise that all the time, but we grew fast, and in the early days, the more cash you can preserve, the better. And so when you buy raw materials and you hold all those raw materials on the balance sheet, that sucks up a lot of cash. And you know, turning those raw materials into accounts receivable, it takes time. So what I would say, kind of even got sub $15 million in sales, if you can create the relationship with an outsourced manufacturer where, you know, you create the spec and you can monitor the supply chain, but you get them to do all the buying of the raw materials and you just pay for an out the door finished good, that will serve you far better than holding a bunch of, you know, raw ingredients and packaging materials, all these things on your balance sheet early on. I think that's a $100,000 tip I could give to people, because if you can transfer, right, and if you're doing $2 million in sales, you know, and you've got to keep $500,000 of raw materials on your balance sheet, and you get someone else to do it for you, and all you have are finished goods, you're in a much better cash position, number one. Number two, you can usually borrow on finished goods. So if you have to go to a lender, you can borrow on finished goods. You can't borrow on, you know, garlic powder sitting in your kitchen. But you can borrow a finished good. So, you know, it gives you leverage on both sides. You have more cash, and then you also have the ability to borrow if you need it.
I love that insight. Definitely, you know, from an accounting background, the cash leveraging from a debt financing funding standpoint is a huge huge key. You know, when clients come to work with Accountfully, we definitely go through a supply chain kind of discovery, inventory discovery process. So we understand what is all incorporated in your finished good, like kind of calculate those landed costs. You know, we can implement an inventory system, things like that, that kind of go along the way. And it's interesting because the companies that are just starting or have those four or five SKUs you're selling, it's like the ones that can get that turnkey relationship and they have clearly have control or oversight on the product and quality control of it. They're literally able to go and do different things and focus on growing top line, growing brand awareness, and they can work on the margins over time as they get volume discounts. As even they get $10, $15 million, get more money, then you get in-house or bring it in-house or manufacture it when you have sufficient cash to hire the labor and purchase the equipment. But if that's one thing off your brand and you're just, you can, it's more of a sales and marketing play. If that's what you're really good at, then, you know, use an expert to do it along the way. So I really think that that's great information. And you guys are continuing to do that now?
Yeah. We still have turnkey operations. You know, I think we're probably at, we're very close to the point where we should now re-explore bringing that sourcing process back in-house. But, you know, early on, and we thought we could do it early on, but the margin contribution doesn't impact the bottom line enough early on. So again, sub 10, 15 million bucks in sales, it doesn't. The cash is way more important. So if you give up a couple points in margin along the way to have somebody else keep all those raw goods on their balance sheet, it helps you grow and focus on things you're good at. But we're sort of just at that point. I mean, the only, you know, there's a little bit of packaging material that we source ourselves and hold on our balance sheet. But I would say 90 or 95% of raw goods are outsourced at this point from a standpoint of, you know, again, we monitor every spec and, you know, we're very much in control of suppliers and who we buy from. Someone else just pays for it up front.
Yep.
And that's been huge for us.
That's awesome. In terms of kind of from, again, 5 years ago to where you are now, like, how did you handle the operations and the purchasing of inventory? Like, who handled that? Was that internally or in-house or externally? What system did you use? Kind of just provide a little insight into that and kind of what were maybe some best practices that you've identified in that space.
Well, you know, early on, we had somebody really great that worked with us who sort of grew up with us from day one, but didn't have a background in operations or supply chain necessarily, but could just was really structured and organized and could kind of keep the creative kind of, you know, flighty entrepreneur in me in check, right? They can kind of create some guidelines for me. And so I had someone that just sort of owned those relationships, and I would have these, you know, these grandiose ideas, and then they would just keep me in check. And again, they were managing the co-manufacturer relationships. And so the co-manufacturer relationships just require somebody who's structured and someone who can manage a schedule and who knows when things are being produced and who knows when we're going to run out of raw materials. We didn't have a lot of systems early on, like spreadsheets. Mm-hmm. And so someone who was just organizing and run spreadsheets helped us do that. And sometimes that was extremely inefficient, but the job got done. Today, you know, and so, you know, we brought people on board along the way that would kind of continue to help us scale. Today we have, you know, a full on, you know, supply chain team that has a lot of experience in consumer products and brought over and came from enterprise level businesses and brought sort of some enterprise level, structure and sophistication to what I would consider a startup or an emerging brand, which helped us scale. Now, again, the systems aren't overly sophisticated. I don't think anyone at 1 or 2 million or even at 10 million needs to run out and get NetSuite and, you know, all of these big sophisticated software systems. We ran on spreadsheets, you know, over, you know, probably until we crossed the $10 million revenue mark. It was mostly spreadsheets and QuickBooks. Mm-hmm. And even today, you know, we still use QuickBooks Enterprise from a financial standpoint, but we integrated that with a, you know, what I think is sort of an entry-level ERP system that helps with the inventory management simply because we have multiple warehouses and multiple manufacturing facilities. And so we have a very entry-level ERP called Fishbowl that we use, and it gets the job done. It's relatively inexpensive. Integrates with QuickBooks, integrates with Shopify. And so they all speak to each other from an inventory standpoint. But we just have in-house accounting. We have in-house supply chain managers. We have in-house operations managers. And you know, until you can get to that point where you can justify the full-time hire in those spaces, you know, outsourcing it to the extent that you can is also fine. There are experts in the operations space that can help you create some of that. Obviously, you know, we outsourced the, you know, everything from bean counting to CFO level reporting early on. And that was immensely helpful because we could, you know, we certainly weren't in a position to hire a CFO and a staff accountant and, you know, an AR manager and all that sort of early on. But early management, it was spreadsheets and whatever we could kick out of QuickBooks. And so today, we still use spreadsheets today quite a bit, but, you know, we've systemized it to the extent that, you know, we can manage what's in our warehouse, we can manage our production schedule and the demand plan and forecasting, and we do that across QuickBooks, Fishbowl, and, you know, some other, you know, you could throw in a Tableau type software to give you some nice dashboard reporting, but you don't need to overthink that at all.
Yeah. No, I think that's great insight. Like what, you know, for all of our clients, we have them on QuickBooks Online, in spreadsheets, Google Sheets, understanding standard costing up front, like really start doing that, getting an inventory process in place where you do month end counts, where your locations you have inventory to get them in that mindset and that process flow. You know, we have a lot of clients who recommend like deer inventory, which is similar to Fishbowl, SOS inventory. But what I always tell clients is that it doesn't matter which system you use, there always is some level of manual interaction. So some people assume that, well, I'm going to buy NetSuite or I'm going to do this and it should do it automatically. It's like, no, it doesn't matter. So if you're highly organized and you have 10 SKUs you're selling and you're buying a turnkey product in your three locations, you can manage it in the spreadsheet. You just need to be in there every day. You just need to see what's going on. You need to do proper reporting and ensuring you're doing things. So it's not a system isn't going to fix it. You need the people, the processes, the consistency along the way to do it. And that's where it comes into leveraging, you know, upfront, I would say, leveraging outsourced services of ops consulting companies, of accounting and bookkeeping outsourced shops, CFO shops, you know, leveraging technology for a couple hundred bucks a month. It can make your life very easy. But again, it goes back into manual systems and processes. And staying up on that aspect along the way.
100%. And I would say, especially early on, outsource what you're not good at, right? I mean, okay. If you're a supply chain expert, you have a great idea and you launch a product and you know supply chain, fantastic. Go outsource sales.
Correct.
Right? If you're great at sales and marketing, great. Go outsource operations and accounting. I mean, mm-hmm. I'd say, you know, figure out what you're not good at and outsource some of that. That's fine. It certainly helped us scale significantly.
I love it. All right, couple last questions here. Number one, what KPIs should we be reviewing from a financial standpoint, from an operational standpoint? You know, kind of give us a handful or, you know, two to three of them and why you review them and how often you should review.
Yeah, look, I think segmenting financials, we talked about that earlier, to the extent that you, don't overthink it, but to the extent that you could segment, you know, revenue by key account, margins by account and by product, like those are two big ones, right? You need to know what products are making you money, what products you're giving away the most of, and who you're giving it away to, and which accounts are making you money, right? So, to the extent that you can segment where the money's coming from, do that. And we monitor that early. We monitor that now. It's one of the first things I look at. Same thing with distributors. You can see one distributor who's crushing you. And those are also discussions you can have in retail conversations. So if I sit down with a retailer and I say, hey, we use XYZ distributor, and I say, listen, I can't be as aggressive with my marketing plan with you because they take so much money, right? Those are really helpful discussions that, you know, when you're at that table. So we look at that. We watch trade spend very closely. And again, those two big buckets, performance versus non-performance, those are really good indicators for us on what we're giving away and what's driving new sales and trial and awareness. Now, we pay for data today. We didn't do that early on, so we pay for retail data. So we can monitor, like, new points of distribution, velocity by account, and velocity by item by account. So I can tell you, you know, how many units per store per week my barbecue sauce does at Publix. You know, and so we monitor that. So that's something that I think as you get a little bit bigger and a little more sophisticated, you can start to, you know, really pay attention to. Also points of distribution, gains and losses. Those are big things. Retail voids you can get for free. So like if you're like a lot of retailers, whether it be Publix or Kroger or Whole Foods, they have their own portals. A lot of the data, you can access a lot of data for free. And you can see, are there stores that are supposed to be selling your products that are not, right? And so voids are a big thing that we monitor from day one. You know, being in retail, we learned that you have to own the shelf. And so monitoring that was really, really important. Those are like five big ones, right? So, you know, financials by account, by product, trade spend performance versus non-performance, you know, year over year growth. I mean, that's like really simple. Everyone should be able to see that in basic financial reporting, year over year growth. And you can also do that by account and by product.
Yeah.
See which products are not growing and see which products that are.
Yeah.
And as you get a little more sophisticated, you can drill into retail voids and then velocities at, you know, at your key accounts and determine if the product is actually moving at the pace that you expected it to. Those are five really, really important ones that I look at all the time today. And some of those I wish I'd looked at more closely early on.
Awesome. I guess you would say basically stick to a set of KPIs, understand goals, targets, and then make sure you review them periodically to change any tactical and strategic decisions based upon that information.
100%. I mean, you just summarized it perfectly. And we look at all that monthly. I mean, you know, you can look at it monthly. It'll drive you crazy if you look, you know, if you get too crazy monthly. So, you know, watch it monthly and make sure nothing, you know, more sinister isn't going on. And then quarterly is a really good picture. Yeah,
good.
Really good picture.
Awesome. So the last kind of question I have for you, Jason, before we sign off here is give the emerging company brand who's selling online $500,000 of revenue, just starting to kind of create infrastructure, operationally, accounting, finance, etc. Give them one do and one don't that you would do and that you wish basically somebody told you to do and you stuck to 5-6 years ago.
One do, well, I got like six do's, but I'll give you one do. Do keep selling online as long as you can. I would say do keep doing that. Double down on it. Going into brick and mortar retail is really hard. And if you're good at online or good enough to build it to $500,000, build it to 2 million before you go to brick and mortar. Get to a level of scale that you can negotiate with co-packers and have better terms when you go into retail, because in retail your cash cycle is going to stretch. Online your cash cycle is condensed. As soon as you go into retail, you use a distributor, you're going to create a 60, 90, 120 day cash turn cycle. And so you want to be at a certain level of scale. If you can control it, you want to be at a certain level of scale so that you can then extend co-packer terms and raw ingredient terms, and you can kind of try to match that. If I could do it over again, I would do that. I would get really good online, and I would get to a certain level of scale before I even considered brick and mortar retail.
And I think that that's even more key now with what we've seen with COVID, how the e-com space has changed. And I don't think it's going to go back, even once we get back to normalcy. I mean, the people who never bought online are going to keep buying online because they're going to be like, wow, I can just get this delivered to my house. So that's never going to stop. So that's a great insight.
Brad, I have 50,000 points of distribution in brick and mortar retail. And, you know, COVID in particular sort of informing our future decision making. We are quadrupling down on the digital shelf.
Yep.
Because you can control your own destiny. I think consumer behavior is permanently shifting. It doesn't mean people aren't going to grocery shop ever.
100%.
Of course, but I think that behavior is shifting. And you have so many people that will buy online now that weren't previously that. So that company, I would say, keep doing that as long as you can before you go into brick and mortar.
Awesome. And what about the don't?
Don't trade services for equity.
I love it.
Man, it is like the biggest trap. You know, early on, you're strapped for cash. You need somebody to create you a new brand logo, or you need someone to be some consultant to help you. Listen, find a way to pay them cash up front. Don't trade services for equity. If you ever want to trade service for equity, do it with somebody you've been in business with for multiple years. The relationship is good. They add a ton of value to you. They're going to keep adding value. Trap early on, man. So many early stage entrepreneurs trade services for equity, and every single one I've ever met regrets it.
Yeah. No, I think that's an awesome insight. From my perspective, just working with specific clients when I was growing our business, as well as seeing clients like yourself do that, like, I feel like when you're not trading cash, there's never a proper kind of both one side of the party because they're getting screwed, right? You're like, oh, well, that goes to the bottom of their list because they're not getting money for that to support their employees' payroll, their rent, et cetera. And it isn't a fair trade at the end of the day. So I think that's a fantastic insight. So with that being said, we'll end this. Jason, I really appreciate everything. This was awesome. I'm assuming we can find your products at Whole Foods across the nation, anywhere else? What are your brand names or your specific kind of condiments and kind of give some, where can we buy your products at?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I mean, a lot of places. So Whole Foods, everything we sell is in Whole Foods nationally, but most of the Kroger and Kroger banners carry a lot of products that we make. Publix in the Southeast, Wegmans, Meijer, Ralph's, Smith's, Hy-Vee. I mean, most of the major retailers, there's some products even in CVS today, some in Target. And then of course, Amazon and thenewprimal.com. So fortunately for us, we've built a pretty wide network of distribution, but you know, we're also in our eighth year. So, you know, don't expect that overnight either.
Right.
Our eighth year. So this has been a lot of compound interest working for us.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Jason. Really appreciate everything. And hope you all enjoyed episode 1 with Jason Burke from The New Primal of The Month End.